Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you listening. Our guest for the first hour of the show today is Naomi Klein. She is an award-winning journalist and syndicated columnist. A lot of people, I think, will know her for her book, The Shock Doctrine, The Rise of Disaster Capitalism, a book that's been out now for about a year, in which she takes issue with what for a lot of people is an article of faith when it comes to politics and economics. That is that unfettered free markets and democracy go hand in hand. In fact, she argues that in developing countries around the world, in Latin America, in Eastern Europe, and in Asia, that free market principles were forced on people when they were in shock, either from a natural disaster or from political upheaval. The book got a lot of attention and a very strong reaction, both positive and negative. It was named as one of the best books of 2007 by The New York Times, The Village Voice, Publishers Weekly, The Observer, and Seattle Times. Also, a lot of people on the conservative side of the political spectrum were very negative about the book. If you're interested, you head out to the bookstore and take a look at it, and you may certainly judge for yourself. Also, you can see her work. She is a regular columnist for The Nation and The Guardian. And we were just talking about the fact that she has a piece that's going to be appearing in Rolling Stone tomorrow. So either you can go to the newsstand, you can read it online if you want to take a look at it, talking about the response to the current economic crisis. Two other things I want to mention. She'll be appearing in the Author's Corner for a book signing on the U of I campus. This is at the Illini Union Bookstore at noon today. And then also we'll take part in a roundtable discussion at 210, room 210 of the Illini Union, looking at the rise of current social movements and protests in Latin America. That's from 2 to 4. And I am told that it's open to anybody who would like to attend. So again, if you're interested, you can stop by. And certainly you can go out and find The Shock Doctrine if you would like to read the book. Here, questions are welcome. All we ask of people is they just try to be brief so we can keep moving along. Anyone's welcome to call 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Well, thank you very much for being here.
It's great to be with you,
appreciate
David.
It. Just give us if you can, now, the book goes into some length in talking about your ideas and also looks very specifically at different countries and how these things played out. But just give us the thumbnail sketch of the basic argument that you're making in the book.
Well, look, the book is an alternative history of the rise of this radical economic model of deregulation and privatization and cutbacks to social spending that is actually the economic model that is on trial right now in this country. It's what Barack Obama has turned this election into a referendum on, the idea of deregulating, getting rid of common sense rules, as he says, and giving a lot to the people at the top and hoping that it trickles down. And, you know, this debate that's now happening in this country has been happening in a lot of other countries. These policies, although they were cooked up in the United States for the most part under what used to be called the Washington Consensus, were test driven for the first time in Latin America, and particularly in Chile with the help of the so-called Chicago Boys. I raise that because of where we are. Mm-hmm. But the thesis of the book is that we have been living with a fairy tale version of history. We've been told that this ideology swept the world on the wings of freedom and democracy. We're usually told that it started with Reagan and Thatcher, not with Pinochet in Chile. And what I do in the book is I start where it really started. I show the violence that worked hand in hand with this, with the imposition of this economic model. But what I mean by the shock doctrine is a strategy of power that has been well understood by top level economists and policymakers now for many years, which is that these policies are actually quite unpopular for the most part. Everyone likes a tax cut, but generally people protect their labor standards, their environmental standards, their public services. So a crisis is needed, some kind of a shock, in order to prepare the ground for the imposition of these policies. And I want to be very clear that I'm not arguing that they create the shocks deliberately in order to exploit them, mm-hmm. but I am arguing that there is a comfort level with crisis because it is understood that that any kind of crisis, whether it's an economic shock or a war or a period of rapid transition from one regime to the next, like after the collapse of the Soviet Union, anything that makes a society lose its bearings creates a window of opportunity when, if you're ready, if you're the one who's ready, you can ram through changes very quickly and all at once before people get their bearings. This is a tactic that is often called shock therapy because you're pushing through the whole package all at once. And I start the book with a quote from Milton Friedman, the sort of guru of this deregulation mania, the University of Chicago professor, the late Milton Friedman, saying, "Only a crisis, actual or perceived, produces real change. And when that crisis occurs, the change depends on the ideas that are lying around." And then he goes on to say, "That, I believe, is our basic function, to keep the ideas ready until the politically impossible becomes politically inevitable." And so I look at how that idea, which I think is actually, you know, any crisis begs a response. I mean, any crisis is telling us there's something wrong with the system. It's sending us a message. But what I'm tracking is a very anti-democratic impulse. It's the idea of harnessing the disorientation and the fear of a crisis to come in with the prepackaged ideas, the experts ready to go, and just pushing it through before people, you know, are back on their feet. And I start the book with actually a current example, which is New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina, where at New Orleans, the public schools were transformed to charter schools, public hospitals were closed, the housing projects were shut down, turned into mixed-use housing and condominiums, while the people weren't even there. And that's what I mean by the shock doctrine. And another phrase I use to describe this is disaster capitalism. But my point here is not to say that, you know, we need to just go back to the way things were before the crisis, but that this is, we need to understand that this is a very anti-democratic impulse.
Mm-hmm. I think just maybe I would ask you just to talk a little bit further about one particular place, because I think that some people have argued that it may be, looking at the examples that you present, it may be in fact the best argument, and that is what the Coalition Provisional Authority did in Iraq after the toppling the regime of Saddam Hussein.
Yeah. And that's actually the origin of this project for me. I went to Iraq in the first year of the U.S. occupation. I was writing about it for Harper's Magazine. And I wrote an article for Harper's that, you know, some of your listeners may have read if they're Harper's readers, called Baghdad Year Zero, Pillaging Iraq in Pursuit of a Neocon Utopia. The article came out on the one-year anniversary of the occupation, of the invasion, and it looked at the strategy, you know, and argued that what we've been told again and again, which was that the problem, everything went wrong in Iraq because the Bush administration didn't have a plan, was quite mistaken. The truth was that they had a plan. It was just a very bad plan, and the plan backfired. But what the plan was to deliberately harness the shock and awe invasion. That was the shock in Iraq, obviously, to push through what Joseph Stiglitz, the Nobel Prize-winning economist, described as the most radical dose of economic shock therapy ever attempted anywhere, including the former Soviet Union. Paul Bremer, head of the CPA with absolute authority to write laws and impose them on the Iraqi people, wrote more than 100 laws, most of them focused on the economy. And it was really, actually, the Financial Times described it as the wish list for foreign investors. They tried to do in Iraq things that the Republican Party has never been able to accomplish in the United States, like impose a flat tax, a 15% flat tax. They announced the privatization of Iraq's top 200 state companies. And I visited a lot of these companies, spoke to the workers, spoke to the managers, who were who really saw this not as sort of a technocratic transformation, which is the way it was being sold, but really as a continuation of the war, as the pillage after the war, that they felt that their national resources were being looted from under them, and a lot of people joined the resistance at that point.
We have a caller here, and I think perhaps we'll have some others. Naomi Klein is our guest. She is an award-winning journalist. She's a regular columnist for The Nation and The Guardian. She's a syndicated columnist for The New York Times, author of the best-selling book, The Shock Doctrine, The Rise of Disaster Capitalism. Questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And let's talk with someone here in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Thank you, and thank you, Naomi, for all your great work, and including your documentaries as well as your books. I was at last night's talk that you had, and speaking of, you know, various disasters, using that shock to impose things, and the resistance to that, I was kind of taken by your assumption and others that Barack Obama is going to be allowed to win the election. I think there's a lot of evidence that the election was stolen in 2004 in Ohio, and we know for a fact that Gore got more votes in Florida in 2000. The Supreme Court, of course, was assisting in stealing that election. But given your experience, I wonder, what do you think people can and should do if we end up, I mean, I hope this doesn't play out, but I will not be shocked if the election is stolen again. And I'm just wondering, you know, given the propensity of the Democrats to roll over, certainly Kerry didn't even put up a minimal fight last time after the election was stolen. What do you think we should try to do, those of us who are upset by this?
Thanks for that. Thanks for that call. Yeah, and I did. I gave a lecture last night at the university, and I kept having to catch myself because I kept sort of acting as if it was clear that Obama was going to win, and talking about what people's strategies might be after that, and sort of anticipating the way the Republicans in opposition will use the economic crisis that they themselves have created to undercut Obama's policies and campaign promises, to say, you know, we can't afford all these things you've promised because we're in a crisis now. That's one of the uses of crisis. But yeah, I did keep having to catch myself going, wait a minute, we can't get too cocky here. You know, I certainly think that the caller makes a very, very good point about the dirty tactics that were used in 2000 and 2004. And I think that in this country, when elections are very close, it does appear to be possible to steal an election. And I agree that pretty much happened in 2000. I think the hope for Obama is that he is further ahead, than either Gore or Kerry. And that when you have a significant margin, it becomes a lot harder to steal an election. That's why it is so important not to get overconfident in this moment, because the dirty tactics we're already seeing, and the only protection against it is just a massive voter turnout. So the fear, and I know that the Obama campaign is very afraid about this, is that, you know, all of the polls showing him with a decisive lead are going to make people complacent about coming out on Election Day, lose some of that urgency, and then they lose that buffer that is so important. But in terms of, you know, the other thing that the caller mentioned about previous Democratic candidates rolling over, you know, I think if Obama found himself in that situation and he rolled over as quickly as his predecessors did, there would just be outrage across this country. And I think he knows that.
Well, one thing, though, that people seem to be not talking about in terms of how the elections are stolen is massive electronic fraud. And, you know, just it wouldn't matter how many people turn out if you're flipping enough votes, and I think there's credible evidence that around 500,000 votes were flipped in Ohio electronically. You know, once it went through the process, and there's no way at this point. It is possible to do, but there is no mechanism in place to audit the custody of the electronic voting process, so that, you know.
If I can just say, you know, this is not actually my area of research. You know, there's a lot of people who've done some really great research on this. I'd recommend the writings of Greg Palast, for instance, but this isn't my area. But I would just say, you know, there is another Naomi out there, Naomi Wolf, who does a lot of writing talking about, you know, a slide into fascism and electoral theft in this country. I actually don't go that far because I think that one of the things that happens when we hear this message is that people think that it isn't even worth trying. I mean, if it's too late, if the elections are fixed, why even bother participating? And frankly, I do think that it is worth participating. I don't think this is by any way a foregone conclusion. But I do think that if Obama does manage to win these elections, because people come out in massive numbers, then electoral reform and campaign finance reform and media reform and all the things that keep the democratic process broken on a systematic level need to be at the top of the agenda. And the issues that you raise, like electronic voting, also, I would say, campaign finance reform, even though campaign financing has worked in Obama's favor in this election, that shouldn't mean that it's off the agenda. Money plays far too big a role in politics. And the fact that so many, trade unions are blowing their budgets buying commercials in corporate media, to me, is an outrage. They should be using that money on organizing and on popular education, not giving the money to CNN and MSNBC. So I think we've got a lot. These are all good issues. But I would just caution against a message of, it's all too late. It's, it's rigged from the start.
I hope the caller will forgive me. I appreciate his comments. I have others. Let's go next to a caller in Effingham. This is a line 4. Hello.
Yes. Two questions. What are your feelings about the imperialist stage, which is pretty far out there? But the world has become imperialized through capitalism. And what do you have any comment about that? And I have one other question.
Well, do you want to have her respond to the first point first?
All right. Yes.
Well, I think we've been in the imperialist stage for quite some time now. So I'm not sure specifically what you're referring to, but I do think that as natural resources, energy resources in particular, become scarcer, that we see a more unmasked imperial aggression in the scramble for scarce natural resources. And, we know that around oil, but I think we're going to see it around water as well. The phase that we have been in, which in Latin America is called neoliberalism, where the centerpiece of the policies is privatization of the state. It's another kind of imperialism in a way, because it isn't just the pillaging of the natural resources of the state, as those are ongoing, but now it is also, in a way, the pillaging or the privatization of the assets, of the hard assets of the state, like roads, bridges, water systems. This is the sort of the has been the colonial frontier for the past 35 years.
The other question would be from what I've read, capitalism came into existence as we know it 700 years ago, and now advanced as far as it has, and that those capitalist nations combined represent probably less than 10% of the world's population. And this process goes on, and and Africa I always use as an example of a whole continent of people who have absolutely nothing. And then the U.S., which then represents less than 4% of the world's population and absorbing 55% of its goods. How long can that go on before there is an explosion of a magnitude that we can't imagine, and the lives of people who have never known anything but want? If you could comment on those things, I'll hang up and listen, and thanks.
Thank you. I think we have seen some explosions from excluded people, and this economic model does systematically displace people. It displaces people who were involved in agriculture, sustainable agriculture, who lose their land when agriculture consolidates into the hands of a few big players, and people migrate to cities looking for work. And when they don't get work in those cities, they migrate across borders looking for work. Is why immigration is such a hot issue in this country, because, in Latin America, so many people have been displaced by this economic model. So it's all these issues are interconnected. And one of the things that I look at in the book is the privatization of the containment industries, the industries that contain the people who have been displaced. Some of them are angry. Some of them are just hungry. Some of them are just looking for work. But the response to that, whether it's the so-called homeland security industry, the counterterror industry, or the border control industry, has all been privatized under the Bush administration. They've treated this as a booming new economy that has really replaced the dot-com economy. The homeland security sector, which barely existed before September 11th, is now a $200 billion global industry. And this is the industry of private security, the industry that is building fences on the border with Mexico. All of this is being done by private industry, companies like Blackwater. It's bigger than Hollywood and the music industry combined. So, I don't just see it in terms of the inevitable sort of global revolt. I think we also need to understand that capitalism is already factoring in that resistance and that displacement, that mobility. I don't think it's just that people get angry. I think it's also that they just look for better lives for their families, and that then creates anger and fear in rich countries. And that's fed a lot by the media. There's directing anger at immigrants as opposed to the economic model itself. And the winners of that economic model, and then that becomes the new frontier for privatization, the containment of people, the repression of people. It's all being done by private industry.
Given the fact that this economic model that we're talking about is so firmly entrenched in most of the industrialized world, and those large countries that are rapidly growing and industrializing, where we know we have very large countries, and certainly we have large population base, China, India, Brazil, Russia, those are the ones that are often named, and maybe there are others. Given the fact that they, to one degree or another, have adopted that, how do you even consider the possibility that something else could come along to challenge that model?
China is certainly interesting in terms of what we were just discussing, because China is really the cutting edge of this process, because you have such a huge population of internal migrants in China, what they call the floating population of rural people who go to cities like Shenzhen and Guangzhou and Shanghai looking for work. I was in China recently in the Pearl River Delta for doing a piece for Rolling Stone about American companies like Cisco that are working with the Chinese government to put that migrant population under constant surveillance. And it's actually the fastest growing business in China, the business of surveillance, the CCTV cameras on every lamppost, biometric identification cards, facial recognition software running through these systems. So, in China, you really see the future if you have the stomach to look at it, where, the people are the enemy, and keeping those people under control and under surveillance is, a booming industry that there's a lot of American companies we're very excited about getting into. So that's, I guess, the downside. I think we are seeing examples of countries that are rejecting the economic model and trying to build alternatives that are based on democracy and based on sustainability. And I think we see that most clearly in Latin America. And this was, the lecture I was giving last night about the roots of this economic model in Latin America, but also the fact that Latin America is at the forefront of the resistance to this economic model. I would argue because these policies came to Latin America first, Latin America is, Latin Americans are the first to resist them. They've had more than three decades of giving these policies a chance to make good on the promises of poverty alleviation. They haven't. And you see that so clearly in countries like Bolivia, where disparity has increased so dramatically. And now you have a wave of politicians in Latin America like Evo Morales, Rafael Correa, who I think studied here, in Ecuador, who came to power on a campaign that specifically was rejecting privatization, deregulation, promising to renationalize parts of the economy, to redistribute land, and I think that these are, you know, even though there are many of these leaders like Hugo Chavez and Evo Morales are often vilified in the American press, I see them as, you know, though they have their flaws, these represent the most hopeful alternatives to the failure of this economic model, and we shouldn't be so quick to dismiss them.
We are at our midpoint here. We have a caller. We'll get to him right in a moment. For anyone who has tuned in just in the last 5 or 10 minutes, I want to introduce again our guest, Naomi Klein. She is an award-winning journalist and regular columnist for The Nation and The Guardian. She is the author of the bestseller, The Shock Doctrine, The Rise of Disaster Capitalism, that was published September of last year and is now available in paperback. So if you want to read the book, it's out there. She's here visiting the campus. She gave a talk last night. She also will be making an appearance, doing a book signing in the author's corner of the Illini Union Bookstore at noon today. So that's one way you could meet her and get a copy of the book. Also, she'll be taking part in a roundtable discussion in room 210 of the Illini Union from 2 to 4, looking at the rise of current social movements and protests in Latin America.
Very relevant to that last caller.
She is. And we also want to acknowledge the folks at the Center for Latin American and Caribbean Studies here at the U of I for being her sponsor and making it possible for her to be here on this program. Questions, comments, welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222. 9455, and we have another caller here where we are, Champaign County. This is line number 2. Hello.
Hi. On the vilification of the leaders in Latin America, it seems to me that when you have a media that can, you know, talk about Chavez and even have Obama talk about him as a dictator when, advocating for term limits, he was reelected five times, and they have recall. I think the constitutional provisions that would have allowed getting rid of term limits did adjust the ratio for the recall. But, I mean, in a country like ours that has been flagrantly violating international law around the world, that has no recourse other than impeachment, there's no popular recall here. For this country to be able to vilify a leader in that situation is just astonishing to me.
It is astonishing when you think about Michael Bloomberg and his desire to eliminate term limits. And, you know, he didn't put that to a general vote, but Chavez did. They had a referendum, and he lost, and he respected the results of that referendum. I don't think he's given up the fight, but...
But the point that I was making is that, you know, they have recall. We don't have a recall, popular recall, which, you know, the history of presidents... through the last four decades would have been completely different if we'd had something like popular recall. And I agree that everyone is human, everyone has flaws, but it just seems the piling on against Chavez. I know you're sympathetic in some ways because you were even saying that last night that the lowering of oil price is going to possibly put the Latin American countries back into some kind of sway of the IMF. The IMF has basically been helping out Turkey for the last decade or so without any real outreach anywhere else in the world, is the way I've heard it characterized. But again, it seems to me the history of Venezuela with the coup that was, you know, plotted by the Times the day after, that was pretty well, in some ways, engineered or blessed by the U.S., a year earlier, during the in Venezuela, during the managerial strike, the same kind of dirty tricks, maybe at a higher level, that were used in Chile to make the economy scream in the famous Nixon quote, were used. You know, there was an accusation by Hector Mondragon of industrial sabotage, where SAIC basically turned off all of the control mechanisms and blew them up, basically, remotely in some way, introduced flaws into their, and turned off the entire refinery pipeline system. And we don't, no one has written very much in English about this except this fellow I named. I'm glad, I'd just like for you to respond to this, and I really do applaud your work, and I think maybe the Harvard boys might bear a little scrutiny, too, as you go through the hour. Thank you.
The Harvard boys. Thank you for that call. And I want to thank you in particular for mentioning Hector Mondragon, who's a wonderful Colombian economist, specializes in agrarian reform and energy policy. He writes in Spanish, but a lot of his work has been translated into English. And you can read it on a blog called killingtrain.org. Or you can search on his name, Hector Mondragon. But I think I agree with pretty much everything you said about Venezuela. I think that most significant thing that's been happening on the continent over the past 5 years has been the space that has been purchased to develop economic alternatives, because Venezuela has been able to step in for the IMF and be a lender of last resort for countries that needed it. So they didn't have to go to Washington, didn't have to go to the International Monetary Fund, get a loan, and then be told that they needed to structurally readjust their economies and lose their sovereignty. He's been handing out loans without strings attached. And because of that, there's just been some breathing room to develop alternatives, which are so needed in this period. I agree. I think that Chavez enjoys this sparring, enjoys the limelight, deliberately antagonizes the U.S. and has fun doing it. And I think there's a lot of debates about whether he's doing his country a service or not with some of his rhetorical tactics. But on the ground, it's clear that he does not have absolute power. And we see that with the results of the referendum, where he was trying to push through a series of constitutional changes. Some people didn't like the process that was behind it, and he lost that referendum. He respected the results. I'm not sure how much I can add to that. But thanks for your comments.
Others are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. So I wanted to shift just a little bit and talk about the current economic crisis and the response to it. Now, as people know, the government, the United States government, has made moves to involve itself in the economy to the extent that it has not before, and that seems to be in conflict with what has been this prevailing philosophy that says, okay, unfettered free markets, hands off, unless the government's involved, the better. And certainly some people within the Republican Party have actually been very critical of this, saying, no, we're abandoning our principles. We shouldn't be doing that. That's not what we said we were going to do. We should be doing all these years. So perhaps the question is, does this actually mark some kind of shift in philosophy and commitment to this idea of unfettered, let the market rip?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a really interesting question, and it's a complicated one to answer. Certainly what they are doing in buying equity in potentially thousands of banks. I mean, the first wave was the big nine, but now they're saying that for the second wave of the equity buys, this is under the new Paulson plan, where they're buying equity in banks in order to encourage them to lend, except they didn't get that part in writing. And the banks are saying, actually, we think we'll keep the money and give it to our shareholders and pay our bonuses and maybe buy other banks. So if that was really their goal, and I'm not so sure that was really their goal, they did a terrible job of negotiating that deal, which is interesting considering Henry Paulson spent 32 years at Goldman Sachs and knows how to make a good deal if he wants one. We have the rhetoric, which is this laissez-faire rhetoric. I don't believe that this transformation of the global economy has really been driven by ideology. I think it's been driven by greed, frankly, by the interests of multinational corporations. And at certain points, it does serve to embrace this idea of deregulation. But at other points, they're fully in favor of intervention and of an active government. If you think about a free trade deal, that's a very active government. That's the government going in on behalf of multinationals, negotiating deals, writing rules, regulating, but regulating in the interests of corporations. For instance, telling China you have to respect, the intellectual property rights for Microsoft and for the drug companies. That's regulation. It's very aggressive regulation. So The deregulation that the financial sector has fought for and won so many victories over, that's deregulation that has allowed them to accumulate huge profits over the years. So the ideology is never imposed with consistency. And this idea that the Bush administration is suddenly abandoning their belief in free markets, I have a lot of trouble swallowing because, of course, my research and the research, you know, in the shock doctrine is about this economy that they have built, this home I was referring to earlier, the homeland security economy, looking at Iraq as, you know, a privatized war. Well, there's nothing a free market about the way they've done this. It's no-bid contracts that have been handed out to politically connected companies. They have treated the war on terror as a sort of conveyor belt to take public money and transfer it into private hands to fight this war for them, whether it's border security, private security, companies like Blackwater, Halliburton, the privatization of the Green Zone, all of this. It's all contracted out. This is the hallmark of the Bush years, has been the contracting out of functions of government, which were considered so core to our idea of the state that, you know, there's real arguments to be made about whether this is even constitutional or not, because this is the mandate of any government is security. They've contracted that out. So, you know, I see actually a real consistency where they spend the first 7 years taking taxpayer money and giving it to politically connected companies without open competition, essentially in exchange for campaign contributions. And then as their final gift, they take the private debts of Wall Street and transfer them to the public. So I don't believe this is a government that ever really matched the ideology with action. We've seen, you know, an explosion in the size of government, in the size of the deficit, and a very interventionist government. And really what I think is best described as corporatism, not free market policies, of an alliance between big business and big government. And we've seen that in many countries that have embraced these policies. But certainly I think that this bailout itself is it's not what we've been sold. You know, when Paulson did his about face, the first plan, right, was to buy $700 billion worth of what they're calling toxic debts.
Right.
And that was plan A. Then in the negotiations after Congress voted against it, the Democrats managed to get a clause in there that gave Treasury the right, if they wanted it, to also buy equity in banks. But it didn't. It said that they could, not that they must. But it gave them the power to do that. Then Gordon Brown came along. And he actually nationalized a few banks, some of them completely, others of them partially, and negotiated in exchange for that pretty good shareholder, pretty good dividends, 12%. He also got voting rights, seats on the board, required that these banks start lending again to homeowners and small businesses and students. The European Union followed suit, and the market actually responded more positively to these nationalizations of the banks than to the Paulson plan, which the market actually didn't respond to well. It crashed immediately after it was passed, which sort of tripped up their whole logic that this was actually going to send a message of security to the market. So then we heard that Paulson was going the Gordon Brown route and was as partially nationalizing the banks. What I'm arguing in the Rolling Stone piece, and I'd encourage people to take a look at it. They can read it on the Rolling Stone website tomorrow or on my website, naomiklein.org, is that this is not partial nationalization at all, that there's absolutely no power for taxpayers. In sharp contrast to the British deal, there's only 5% returns in exchange for massive equity investments. Citibank alone got $25 billion. It's not a very good deal, especially when Gordon Brown had just negotiated 5 days earlier a benchmark of 12%. Once again, you know, where's the Goldman Sachs man when you need him, who knows how to negotiate a deal? No voting rights, no seats on the board. And they said the goal of this plan, Henry Paulson said when it was announced to taxpayers, was to address the credit crunch. He said these banks can't hoard the money. We need them to deploy it. That was his quote. Well, then 3 days later, the banks started issuing their quarterly earnings and having conversations with analysts. And in these conversations, they said what they thought they would use the money for. And we heard a range of ideas from Citibank saying we're going to use it on mergers. Morgan Stanley looks set to spend it on bonuses. There is an article in the Washington Post today saying that we can expect at least a third of the money to pay off shareholders. None of them seem to have any intentions of spending it in anytime soon on loans. So what kind of nationalization is this, where all the risk, all of the money is public, but none of the power is?
Let's take another call. We have somebody in Urbana, line number one. Hello?
Hello?
Yes?
Yes. In India, for example, in 1992, the state was pretty much bankrupt. And World Bank and the IMF were involved, but we didn't see the kind of crackdown that you described in many other states where IMF got in and the Milton Friedman doctrine seemed to have been applied with devastating effects on people's lives. Do you see any reason, or what reasons do you see that if this kind of thing did not happen in India as against in other countries, although India was pretty much at the bottom? I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
It's a very good question. All these questions have been good. It's interesting. I have a blurb on my book jacket from one of my favorite writers, Arundhati Roy. And when she sent me the blurb, she said, "I'm going to send you this." And it's a very kind endorsement of the book. She said, "I'm going to send you this, even though you have a blind spot for India," because it's true. I should have had a chapter in the book on India. And you know, I think that part of the reason why I didn't write on India is because it's just so complicated and so huge, and it doesn't exactly fit this model. But neither, I think, can you say that it doesn't fit it. You know, it is complex, and there has been an enormous amount of repression in India that has accompanied the imposition of neoliberal economic policies, which have been mandated in exchange for loans. You see it more on a project by project basis. I mean, you see it, and you know, this is where Arundhati's writings have been so powerful. For instance, around the Narmada Dam, which was originally backed by the World Bank, and caused massive displacement and the drowning of many, many villages. And as people resisted the dam, they encountered a huge amount of repression. And that pattern has repeated across the country, whether it's a mine or a dam. There have been a huge amount of state repression used in order to protect these neoliberal mega projects. And of course, you know, the suicide rate for Indian farmers is absolutely staggering. I think it's something like 24 million people a year are taking their own lives in India because of the debt accumulated by farmers. So this certainly has been a violent, wrenching process. But one of the things that India is a democracy, and it has been the protection of that democracy, flawed as it is, as usual, that I think has prevented this from going further. And one of the things that is, really difficult for Indians in this process is that investors are constantly pitting China against India, because China is such a better place to invest, and such a better place to invest because the people are so much more tightly controlled. The workers are so much more tightly controlled. Rural people are so much more tightly controlled because of the reasons we were discussing earlier. These are the two big fast-growing emerging markets, and you hear all the time these complaints about how, you know, how much better it is to do business in China than it is to do business in India. And the reason for that is, frankly, democracy. You know, democracy does make things messier. People are able to protest. They are able to resist. They can vote out a government that they don't like. And you know, I think that that has prevented this process from accelerating further.
All right. We have about 5 minutes left. I have another caller here in Champaign. Let's get them. And this is line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
When your book was published, the New York Times ran a review by Joseph Stiglitz, which I thought was condescending would be maybe the nice way to put it. Snotty may be more accurate. Do you see a principal difference between the sorts of things Stiglitz has been saying recently and your view? I mean, did the review mask a real difference, or was it just a competition?
You know, I really like Joseph Stiglitz, and I didn't, you know, I think that the review was maybe, you know, I didn't see the review as all that bad, to be honest with you. I was surprised that it wasn't worse, given what the New York Times often does with
right.
books like mine.
Uh-huh.
You know, I think I think the main difference, and I think it is a real difference, is that I talk about the link between violence and these economic policies.
Mm-hmm.
Joseph Stiglitz has done fantastic writing about the incredible dislocation and poverty that has been created by shock therapy in Russia, for instance. And I think that where my book is different is that I'm not only talking about the poverty that is created by these economic policies. I'm also talking about the force required to impose these economic policies and drawing a connection between coup d'etats, between massacres and between the use of torture and these economic policies. And I think for economists, for classically trained economists, that is really outside the paradigm of what you're supposed to do in looking at the effects of economic policy. This linking of political and repressive context, linking real world violence with economic policies, is just seen as a little bit out there. And but that said, I've done events with Joseph Stiglitz. We did an event recently in New York City at CUNY. We get along very well. And at all of my speeches, because I've been on a speaking tour now for a couple of months, I have been telling audiences, and I'll say it again, that I think one of the first demands that should be made of Barack Obama if he wins the election is that he not appoint someone from Wall Street to be Treasury Secretary. This has been the pattern again and again. It was certainly true under Clinton with Robert Rubin. I'm very worried that Barack Obama will go that route in order to send a reassuring message to the market to say, don't worry, I know I've been talking about change, but that was just on the campaign. It's all going to be the same. We're going to have economic continuity. You know, he's always talking about it. He hangs out with Paul Volcker.
Yeah.
And so I think it would be great if it was somebody who wasn't from Wall Street, if it was someone who predicted this collapse before it happened, somebody who saw the dangers of deregulation before last Tuesday. And to me, when I think about who the best person for that job, to me, the name is Joseph Stiglitz. I think he'd be fantastic. So he can condescend to me all he wants. I think he should be the next Treasury Secretary.
I think Larry Summers probably has an inside track there, but
Larry Summers, I'm hoping, has a little too much baggage from all the women he alienated at Harvard to get the job. I hope.
I need to jump in. I hope the caller will forgive me. I'm down to the point where I have about a minute or so left. I guess, as I read some of the criticism of the book, I think some of the people have said that there was a confluence of interests between repressive governments and global corporations and people here in the United States who had a particular economic or political philosophy to press. And that what happens is that it just happened to be that all of their interests converged. And the one thing perhaps they question is your making this argument that it almost makes it sound, and you'll forgive me that this is probably going too far, but it almost makes it sound as if they kind of all sat down together and decided, okay, this is what we're going to do. And that, in fact, I think some people might even be prepared to argue that, you know, instead of these people, some of these people being evil, it was almost that they were clueless, that they just, it just sort of was a matter of luck that all of their interests seemed all of to come together and kind of each sort of underpin the interests of the others.
Well, I think it depends on the case that we're talking about. I do think that there was a confluence of interests and of historical forces, for instance, that created the context in Chile where a desire to overthrow Salvador Allende because he was threatening economic interests in the United States and in Chile converged with, you know, just an accident of history that there happened to be a group of University of Chicago trained economists who came to the University of Chicago in the 50s and 60s, not anticipating this event, but were all trained up and ready to go and ready to work for Augusto Pinochet the day after the coup and turn Chile into a laboratory for neoliberalism. Now, that's not a conspiracy. That's just an accident of history, that the desire to overthrow Allende converged with the fact that there were these economists who had their own vision and saw this as their moment to act. But I don't buy this idea that they're just clueless. I think that's willful blindness at best, a denialism at worst. And I think economists do need to be held accountable for the political context in which their policy recommendations can be enacted. And the idea that you could have a radical capitalist revolution in Chile in the 1970s and do it peacefully is insane. You know, Chileans had just elected a Marxist as their president. It was a left-wing country. If you want to turn it into a little laboratory for Chicago school politics and privatize Social Security and introduce a flat tax, you have to answer the question, what are you going to do with all those leftists? And I am arguing that the reason they were disappeared, the reason they were tortured, the reason they were imprisoned, the reason they were killed, the reason they were exiled was to get them out of the way in order to make this experiment possible. Some of the economists actually admit this. Some of the Chilean economists say, of course, we needed Pinochet's strong hand to do this. Some of them, generally the American ones, say, no, we were against his human rights violations, but we thought he had very sound economic policies. I think that that is just implausible.
Mm-hmm. We're going to have to stop. We've come to the end of the time. You can read her book. It's The Shock Doctrine, The Rise of Disaster Capitalism. It's now in paperback. You can also read Naomi Klein in The Nation, The Guardian, the piece that you mentioned about the response to the economic crisis here. You can see that in The Rolling Stone. You can read it online starting tomorrow.
It's the issue with AC/DC on the cover.
Oh, you can, rock on, dude. You can also go to Naomi Klein.com and you can read it there starting tomorrow. She'll be doing a book signing at the Illini Union Bookstore at noon today in the Author's Corner. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you. It was really fun.